information going into it. Since the first scientific journal was established in 1665, the tradition of open science has been the primary way research was conducted and published, especially in public universities. A non-market set of incentives and standards evolved to deal with questions of authorship, publication, quality, ethics, and plagiarism. But this tradition has changed as more and more scientific research enters the marketplace, and research is seen increasingly as intellectual property owned by the corporate or governmental agency that funded it. Since the 1980s especially, notable changes in national science policy and funding have brought more corporate and military dollars into the university campus as more general funding sources have dwindled. What are the benefits and drawbacks of the changed funding structures for scientists and the public? What constraints or conflicts are introduced into research and development? How do these changes affect non-science research on campus? And why is this of significance to the public? So I'm Sarah. This is one conversation of many happening in conjunction with a project that I call the Public Square, which attempts to meet spaces and discourse. So having conversation on or events dealing with public matters happen in spaces where those conversations are often overlooked. So that's why I'm here today, and as I said before, I want to learn.
Well, let's see. I'm Stuart Levy. I work for the NCSA, and it's something like a visualization group, but not exactly. Making animations and producing software. I guess that's an introduction.
I'm Ian Goldberg with J. Goldberg Events Entertainment, and have the Canopy Club here in town. And a friend of John's invited me to come up.
My name is Rosemary Brown. I'm a graduate student in the Department of Physics, and I currently work in a federally funded lab studying theoretical biophysics, which happens to be a field that is enjoying increased corporate funding from pharmaceutical companies. So I feel fortunate to actually be in a publicly funded setting, despite my work.
My name is Kevin Hamilton. I teach in the School of Art and Design, where I teach primarily video and sound. And I'm new here, and I'm also new to public institutions, so I'm really learning about what comes with that in terms of my responsibility.
The diversity, synthesized diversity.
And it's for, like, you can use it outdoor, and it broadcasts to...
Oh, yeah, outdoor diversity works really easy. You probably go from here to that building without any locks.
Wow.
Stuart.
You need a little mic stand.
It's your energy.
Yeah, it must be your voltage charge or something.
It's your arm.
Shorting out the system. Sure, if you went and stuck your hand in the generator over there, you could probably some polarities or something.
I was just
over there
like 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had to print something out, you know, and it's the most reliable place. So. I mean, it's more reliable than NCSA, so I was like,
well, that's good. Your house?
My house isn't reliable at all. I have an inkjet printer that runs out of ink after about 3 weeks or something. But we gotta get locked in.
They do. It's true.
I emailed you this morning about, like, I usually read sort of the intro that I sent out the previous night for people, and then usually we go around and do general intros, but John is sort of the intellectual force behind the conversation today, and I'm here to learn. So I would like to just read this and then turn it over to you to do what you see
sure.
fit. Does that sound good?
Sure. Maybe we should all introduce each other.
Yeah. Okay. So the way I was thinking about this conversation going into it, Since the first scientific journal was established in 1665, the tradition of open science has been the primary way research was conducted and published, especially in public universities. A non-market set of incentives and standards evolved to deal with questions of authorship, publication, quality, ethics, and plagiarism. But this tradition has changed as more and more scientific research enters the marketplace, and research is seen increasingly as intellectual property owned by the corporate or governmental agency that funded it. Since the 1980s especially, notable changes in national science policy and funding have brought more corporate and military dollars into the university campus as more general funding sources have dwindled. What are the benefits and drawbacks of the changed funding structures for scientists and the public? What constraints or conflicts are introduced into research and development? How do these changes affect non-science research on campus? And why is this of significance to the public? So I'm Sarah. This is one conversation of many happening in conjunction with a project that I call the Public Square, which attempts to meet spaces and discourse. So having conversation on or events dealing with public matters happen in the spaces where those conversations are often overlooked. So that's why I'm here today, and as I said before, I want to learn.
Well, let's see. I'm Stuart Levy. I work for the NCSA, and it's something like a visualization group, but not exactly. Making animations and producing software. I guess that's an interest.
I'm Ian Goldberg with J. Goldberg Events Entertainment, and have the Canopy Club here in town, and a friend of John's invited me to come up.
My name is Rosemary Brown. I'm a graduate student in the Department of Physics, and I currently work in a federally funded lab studying theoretical biophysics, which happens to be a field that is enjoying increased corporate funding from pharmaceutical companies. So I feel fortunate to actually be in a publicly funded setting, despite my work.
My name is Kevin Hamilton. I teach in the School of Art and Design, where I teach primarily video and sound. And I'm new here, and I'm also new to public institutions, so I'm really learning about what comes with that in terms of my responsibility as an employee of the state, and learning about research structures. Certainly new to this idea of open science, even at all, as I wouldn't have known to phrase it, to know that there are these two ways that we might be talking about here. But I'm no stranger to the real threat that intellectual property as a concept really poses to creative practice right now. And a lot of the work I do and the work I support utilizes other people's work in sampling and reappropriation, and I'm really concerned about the overextension of copyright law and patent law to restrict that kind of work right now. I've also been called upon a lot since I landed at this university to help in the grand scheme of uniting art and science and the Chancellor's Initiative and these sorts of things. I did my graduate work at MIT in a not very technical area, but just having MIT somewhere on my paper seems to get me called upon for these art and technology discussions, and I'm very aware of how often in these discussions I've been a part of, commerce comes up very, very quickly, and I feel bad for that for the sciences as much as I do for the arts. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on this.
I'm Ben Grosser. I direct the Imaging Technology Group at the Beckman Institute, whose mission is to both provide scientific visualization and imaging facilities for the Beckman Institute, as well as to do technology development, which generally falls under the realm of software development that's funded by federal agencies such as NASA, NSF, NIH, as well as writing grants to those agencies for instrumentation and other types of projects. So I think that's probably why I'm here.
I'm John Marturano. I'm a researcher at NCSA, and I'm also a grad student in Graduate School of Library and Information Science, studying communication theory.
My name is David Chang. I'm a research programmer for NCSA. been with the university for about 18 years, first half as a graduate student in computer science, and the second half working for the Automated Learning Group. And I've experienced research in both settings, and it's interesting to contrast the two.
So I prepared a few things to talk about in terms of historical, theoretical background, and I'll try and limit that to 5 minutes, let's say, so that we can actually open it up to discussion. I don't mean to put this out there to try and set the tone of the conversation to be in the realm of history and theory. I more mean it as a backdrop, and you're free to disagree with my interpretation of events. And I am by no means an expert in this area, so you know I may be leaving kind of whole realms out. But I've identified, perhaps the precursor to open science, to take a quote from the book Trust Us, We're Experts. Historically, science has often allied itself with the political philosophy of democracy. To function freely, science depends upon the democratic values of free speech, thought, and association. And in fact, the ancient Greek democracies were the first Western societies to produce a substantial scientific literature. The Dark Ages brought about a return to authoritarian governments and suppression of scientific inquiry, which threatened the absolute dogmas handed down from king and church. So that's kind of the pre-background, but after the, what is sometimes called the Dark Ages or the medieval period, Paul David, a historian of science, places the emergence of open science from the late 16th and 17th centuries. He describes its development as a break from the previously dominant regime of secrecy in the pursuit of nature's secrets. So you had like alchemists and, you can imagine, or maybe not. In any case, he says that medieval experimental science was shaped by a political and religious outlook that encouraged withholding from the vulgar multitude arcane and occult knowledge that might impart immense powers over material things. In any case, the emergence of open science came about as a result of aristocratic patronage. This is Paul David, this is some of his research. It's a result of aristocratic patronage where the aristocrats were able to obtain utilitarian as well as ornamental benefits from funding these scientist experimenters whose projects would often create would reputation aggrandize associated with the patron who was funding them. So it was a way of gaining agency between these patrons, I suppose. So they would, in terms of utilitarian benefit, well, this may not be so utilitarian, but they would, design things like weapons, but also, things that had more practical value for the society. But on the ornamental side, they would put on these things, big fireworks displays and things like this. So as these experiments became ever greater, they also became more risky, and this risked the reputation of the patron if the patron ended up funding a scientist experimenter whose experiment would either fail or be botched or go wrong in a way that could impugn the reputation of the patron. As a result, there was a screening process that was institutionalized by these patrons, having other scientists that had kind of proved their reliability would vet new experiments and new experimenters. And as a result, this is, as David identifies, this is how the peer review system emerged that we have today. So as these these experiments grew, they also required greater funding, and it became necessary for these experimenters to diversify their funding sources, and so you would have multiple patrons funding a particular experimenter, and also, as an implication of that, the experimenters had to begin to publicize their work, and so this is what David points to as the emergence of publishing and the whole kind of system we have today, where we have peer-reviewed, published work, and this is how someone becomes validated in the scientific realm. So, you know, if we jump forward to the establishment of the National Science Foundation, which is, you know, the primary federal agency that, in terms of federal funding, that a lot of us deal with, though I guess there's a lot of others, you know, Department of Energy, and history, I haven't looked into it at all, but in any case, the National Science Foundation was established by Truman in 1950 after a conflict between different groups that held stakes in what the outcome of this would be, and it turns out that that the National Association of Manufacturers played a decisive role in how that legislation turned out. They saw the funding of applied science as being a threat to them in terms of the government funding competition for what the business sector was creating. And so the National Science Foundation was positioned as to fund basic research, right? And this, of course, benefited large firms who would often have a hold on particular markets, as opposed to small firms who are already seeing lots of competition and might have actually benefited from applied research. In any case, if we jump forward during the Reagan era in the 80s, as Sarah was mentioning, NSF was again repositioned, or was repositioned from its inception, to more towards applied research and as well towards an economic justification in terms of the science research in general, because of you know, a number of factors probably, but rising deficits, prolonged recession, and the idea of, you know, that, what's that? Ideology, yeah, and the ideology that was becoming pervasive. But these were all kind of used as justifications for, well, you know, why should, you know, federal funds be going towards, you know, this practice over here? And there was a kind of a shift of justification from, you know, science being inherently valuable society and producing these benefits that couldn't always be predicted or measured, but, you know, were expected to eventually come about, and they were often long-term benefits, and the shift was to one where there was an economic justification where science would have a direct and noticeable boost to the economy, in that products would come out of these institutions and they would expand the market and create more profit potential. So that was, you know, a shift toward adopting more of a market logic. So you know, obviously this, the current trend towards control in the scientific realm is completely different nature than the one that happened during the Dark Ages. So rather than an authoritarian viewpoint handed down from king and church, modern control is more the result of intellectual property right creation in support of commercializing areas of science where profit can be extracted. So I think intellectual property really is the kind of core of, theoretically at least, of the discussion. You know, there's a number of things that can be said about intellectual property right creation, but, you know, one thing is that they often grant a monopoly right, in that if you patent a particular molecular combination for a drug, it's an idea that's being patented. It's not a protection of a thing, you know, like this table. That there's the idea in economics, traditional economic theory, of rivalrous versus non-rivalrous resources, and your car is a rivalrous resource. Your use of it would exclude my use of it at any particular time. Ideas are non-rivalrous resources. Understanding and applying a particular idea, a business practice, a combination of molecules, does not impugn on your ability to do those things. So that gets to the core of whether a particular resource is a scarce resource or not a scarce resource. And traditional economic theory puts forth the idea that the market can most efficiently allocate scarce resources more so than, say, a government or a monopoly. But since ideas and information and these things are not scarce resources, they're non-rivalrous, then traditional economic theory wouldn't think it would apply. And when it is applied, it actually introduces artificial scarcity. And so we see this in predominantly in something like the AIDS conflicts that happen over the AIDS drugs, where there are generic manufacturers that are ready to produce these things for people that need them in third worlds. But an artificial scarcity is introduced because certain companies manage to dominate the role of the production through patent rights that are then enforced and backed up by state power. So I would take that then into the conversation of the commercialized university, where what I see at least is a pervasive market logic that I didn't perceive 5 years ago, because it's one of these things that's so it's so ingrained in the way that we in our experience that it's often hard to recognize the kind of dominant theme in the system that we exist in. I guess I'd like to open that up to a discussion in terms of what people's here experiences might have been with intellectual property right creation, commercializing technologies, funding sources, and how that may have pressured things in a direction of collaboration or in a direction of restricting collaboration, where those tensions lie. I can throw out my own some of my own experience of
I think in thinking about this conversation, I was also thinking about experiences that my father has had. He does social science research, mostly around HIV, AIDS, sexual behavior, and drug use. It was early on in the Clinton administration, so it was probably about 12 years ago, 11, 12 years ago, he was worked on a panel to study the effects of integrating the military, allowing gay and lesbians to be out. And ultimately, you know how that ended up with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The study was funded by the Pentagon. They did a cross-cultural survey of various militaries in industrialized countries with roughly similar socioeconomic statistics, and found that when they had decided to integrate their militaries, they did so with a lot of support from the top, and that there was absolutely no problem. This was really not a popular conclusion, because the military really did not want to admit that it was really their own intransigence that was causing there to be any kind of cultural problems. And so they decided that they owned the findings of the study because they had commissioned it. And they refused to allow them to publish outside of a Pentagon journal. So essentially nobody ever got the study. Clinton never got the study. So in thinking about this primarily as a market commercialized way, I think we might be also missing the ways that intellectual property is used as a mechanism of good old-fashioned social control. And it's not simply that people want to be able to make money and so they're patenting ideas, but they also want to make money off of certain ideas, and there are still other kinds of power relations at work. There's still racism, there's still homophobia, and this becomes almost I think market logic becomes almost if you put things in economic terms, they sound morally neutral. And so I wonder how much market logic is a way of eliding or avoiding certain ethical kinds of questions. So, since it also does seem to happen in research that really can't be commercialized.
connected to that, one thing I was thinking of in your introduction too was that though this is a new history to me, my temptation in the history would be to valorize this kind of pre-commercial understanding of science just generating stuff that's of inherent good. And I would think that would be a wrong way to go, because that approach to science could just as easily be used for this kind of control. And it's something I recognize in the institutionalization of art that I worry about as well. I mean, the place of the Krenner Museum here on this campus is thought to bring an inherent good that I really question, in the same way that I would question our art and design school being turned into a feeder to commercial game design companies or something. Yeah, so your history is familiar to me in that you gave when I sort of look at it through the history of art, and I'm interested in then what a third way might be. Yeah, sorry. Oh, no, I'm just, no, not right now. I gotta think about it.
Well, one of my pet peeves has always been how the science has been funded. I mean, I guess I did like it when NSF funded basic science, because, you know, it seems like all the results were, you know, available for everybody. Now things are very much application short-term driven. And universities are becoming more and more like corporations. I think what needs to happen is society needs to find other ways to reward scientists and people who pursue public knowledge. And I don't know what form that is. You know, it may be just maybe some prize structure. You know, give out millions or billions of dollars in prize money every year to, you know, to scientists. You know, that would certainly fund interest. There might be other ways, but I think trying to directly fund the scientists and not trying to do it through any sort of, you know, commercial filter is probably a better way to go.
Last question I'm curious to ask. You have the first one.
Go ahead and ask your question.
After I graduated from MIT, MIT instituted this policy of open curriculum, where they post all their course materials online. And I was, you know, very excited about that. Anything open, great. But I wondered if, from some of your perspectives, is that any less of a meaningful gesture if a lot of the content is commercialized anyway? I mean, I'd be curious to know anybody's thoughts on the openness in that curriculum. I guess what I wonder is, are there enough other efforts at the university that aren't open because they're basically funded by corporations that snatch up the results right away, that the open curriculum doesn't really matter, or is it a good thing? Any thoughts on that?
I think that open curriculum stuff is great. The whole idea of putting everything online, and MIT being first, is great. I think that as the costs come down, more and more universities can and will do that, and that's great. You know, you're actually providing really, really useful information and knowledge to people. And if you have the time and the constitution, you can just stay at home and learn anything you want.
I think.
No, go ahead. You started your sentence.
Oh, okay. Well, in terms of MIT, it's an interesting case because they're seen as one of the models in terms of universities that are commercializing, because they've really built their foundation on licensing out technologies. And the University of Illinois, for instance, because of very state and federal pressures and reductions in funding and these other institutions that are kind of implementing these policies, there's all this pressure to kind of keep up and get more funding, and also pressure from the state to produce Illinois success stories, as in, you know, businesses that generate more economic output for the state. So the university has a similar interest, and they look to places like MIT as a model, and they see, you know, a lot of people point to, you won't hear this from Office of Technology Management, but a lot of people will point to Netscape as, you know, as something that the university botched and therefore lost potential to make a lot of money off of. And they don't want to see that happen again. And so as a result, I think that's part of why they're so hawkish about technologies at this point. If they see that there's the potential money to be made in an area, then it's much more difficult to try and get that area opened up to open source something. I see things from a software standpoint, because I often, you know, in terms of, you know, is it open source or is it going to be licensed off? You know, there's all kinds of different ways that works out, and that's more what I'm familiar with.
I'm trying to make a structure for understanding this information. So it seems like there's a double set of interests at play. One is for that are intertwined, and one is that the scientists need to have funding, and because of neoliberalization, one of the only ways you can get funding is either through the military or through corporations. Another one is that corporations want socialized, some degree of socialized costs. So if they aren't paying their own research and development staff and having to maintain their own labs and internalize all of those costs, they're able to get some of it at least carried by the state. They've been able to socialize some of their costs and have primary ownership over the benefits. And then the university's interest in it seems very much like to what you just said, that in order for a university to have intellectual primacy, they need to sign on for this sort of activity. They need to see how many corporations they can attract and how many famous products they can spawn.
Because of the reduced funding, there's also, in addition to being reduced funding, there's a pressure to create economic output, like justify your existence. And then there's a response from policymakers at the university level that say, we create economic output, and you need us, and you don't want to reduce our funding because that's going to be problematic. So there's in terms of the economic expansion. So it kind of goes both ways, and it reinforces, I think, the tendency for things to be commercialized.
And in that context, then, it would seem possibly an answer to Kevin's question is that the open curriculum stuff might be great, but if the primary mission of the university is almost shifted from teaching to becoming an economic engine for tech development for the state and for corporations, then they're really not giving up very much.
Something if they can extract profit from it. So if they've given up their curriculum, it's not because, you know, it's because they don't.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if you look at what the U of I has done, they've done, in some sense, the very opposite of what MIT's done. In fact, the teachers and the TAs in the computer science department are cautioned against putting too much material on the web because the CS department runs an internet master's program for which they can charge tuition. So they have an active interest in not making even the curriculum knowledge, which is already out there, open from this university.
I think one of the, go back to your 5 years ago, kind of seeing this emerge 5 years ago, it definitely goes along with funding of the university by the state. You know, right now, of course, we've been in this kind of downward trend of budget cuts for 3 or 4 years or some such, and I definitely have, you know, seen more and more in my position of dealing with budgets that there's a lot of talk about how are we going to replace this money in the university. Where is it going to come from? We can't just keep cutting staff. We can't just close buildings. We have to replace the money. And the answer that comes, you know, rushing in from places like OTM and upper administration is we have to rely on private funding.
can't rely on state funding anymore. State funding accounts for 1/5, I think, of all of the university's funding, which is like $700 million versus $3.5 billion, which is the annual operating budget of the university. And you can't, and this then drives everybody to have to get this federal funding. And I think the cost recovery off of all these grants is increasingly being relied upon for funding general expenses like, you know, the lights and the power and that kind of thing. So I don't know. I think that's certainly an issue that I see the trend of, you know, where has this come from and why has this become so important so recently. I've definitely myself, it's kind of funny that I juxtaposed that with my own experience with OTM, which I think has definitely gained a reputation in stages of different structures of management of that organization here over the last few years. And one of them is that, or actually the thing that's been constant throughout my experience of trying to either license software or just write software that was funded by grants is that they never seem to get it together. Even when you have a product that somebody wants to buy, they can't get it together to make that possible. The lawyer aspect of all these things gets caught up forever, so that by the time they come back and say, okay, now you can license it, the company that wanted to buy it doesn't want it anymore because it's not useful. Or in the case of my own case, trying to just write grants and write software, the language of who owns that source code gets caught up in OTM, so that the funding agency just gets sick of working with you and they don't want to deal with it anymore, and they'll just go find somebody else. When I don't even want to own the source code, I don't even care. I just want to write software and, you know, have a job. So.
The thing that you said about the when you have decreased funding and then there is kind of looking to where are we going to replace this funding with, that reminds me of a broader pattern that I see, well, both at NSF, but currently NCSA is dealing with a situation where there's, I don't know, maybe 3 years of funding coming from NSF and there's no promise of future funding. And so there's the question of whether or not NCSA will continue to exist after 3 years. And so that pressure is made then very, obviated to all the people kind of on down the tree of NCSA. And so where are we going to, one of the pushes is, well, we need to diversify our funding over the next 3 years to be prepared for that. And then the other idea is that, well, we need to understand what NSF wants us to deliver, i.e. a product and or set of products, or and then we need to make sure that we reach those deadlines and that we promise things that we can deliver. So it's very much not as much of a traditional kind of exploratory scientific process as it is one of identifying particular products. Though I would say kind of broadly defined products, you know, like infrastructure, and making sure that we reach those. In terms of NSF's policy, I'm wondering if, and I haven't studied this enough to really kind of stake out a position on this, but I see a pattern where, for instance, with NSFNet, or the internet was, you know, heavily funded in the development stage, and then when they see that something is a success, they say, "Well, we're not here to fund, you know, an ongoing infrastructure. We're here to fund research, and this is no longer research." And so then it gets kind of orphaned and turned over to the market, and then you see the internet, as we've seen in the last decade, really getting privatized, and so. Perhaps this is another round of that happening. You know, are supercomputing centers, for instance, no longer a research interest, and are they ready to turn that over to the market and to see that privatized? You know, what about the next phase of infrastructure that we're going to be developing? And is that something that is, in other words, is it really just kind of a proving ground or an R&D ground for kind of large-scale infrastructure that ends up getting turned over to the private sector so that they can, expand the market logic?
I mean, I think from the perspective of, you know, someone who might be, say, listening or would be wondering why that matters, it's, again, that question of the public is paying twice for these products. So, you know, to play devil's advocate, you could say, what's so wrong with making sure your research has an end user in mind? We don't want to just be, funding people endlessly who are trying to figure out how to turn straw into gold. We want some tangible benefit to the public, but these tangible benefits to the public are things the public pays twice for, once in terms of their taxes that support the basic research, and then again when they buy it. And just from a simple, you know, reflexive notion of fairness, there's something there's something kind of wrong there. Rosemary had, oh, you want to say something?
I was just going to say that I think a part of the whole equation that comes in too, though, is the maintaining the quality of the researcher in certain ways within the university structure when it's competing with a free market system. And you know, kind of, I guess, a question for some of the scientists is, it seems to me that most scientists, and actually the realm I come from the music business, this is a huge issue in the music business right now over, of course, the downloading of music and everything like that, and retaining those intellectual rights. And in that business, it's every band wanting that hit song that's going to make them $1 million. But from a lot of the, especially technology-based scientists, I guess, that I know at the university, there is certainly that interest on a personal level to have that technology that is going to be the next Netscape or be the next big thing that's going to make them rich and make them millions of dollars or, you know, or whatever, or at least financially stable. And hence that I think that the a part of what's developing as well is from that more, I guess, personal or human level of people wanting the opportunity to know that if they develop their technology at the university or they're part of developing that technology or in some way that they have the ability to capitalize on that and to see their money come from that. So, I mean, it's kind of the, I guess what I'm getting at is a part of the question is would research that wasn't commercialized, or if there wasn't this kind of flip to commercialization, would a lot of the more value potentially researchers be right away snatched out of the public domain and taken to another part of
it? I guess a couple of comments. I like your point about the public paying twice, but it seems as though if there could be some way found to structure it, the public should be able to reclaim part of that cost somehow by taxing the use of the commercial use of publicly acquired knowledge. That might be one way to do it. There because commercial organizations that are, or organizations that are commercializing knowledge, really are contributing, even if they're not developing new knowledge. You know, it takes real work to commercialize software or to manufacture drugs or what have you, and so there seems to need to be a way to recognize that. But I haven't seen a sort of an intellectual property tax proposed, and I don't really know how it would work and how you'd prevent the application of a tax from just applying to. You know, what's the difference between an intellectual property tax and a patent? Because you don't want the behavior that we get with patents, which build walls around knowledge so that they can't be used for the duration of the patent, but so that the real value that can be extracted from knowledge, much of which comes somehow from public investment, decreasing in decreasing amounts, but still. But still very important amount, so that can be recovered to the people who supported the research. I don't know. Another leftover comment, thinking about MIT making their making curriculum publicly available, and I guess I'd agree they probably wouldn't do it if they thought it was very important to them. It seems like it's a much better deal for MIT than it would be for many universities. You know, if I were running a university, I'd be very worried to see this. You know, MIT, as you pointed out, John, has many other sources of funding. It's very well established and doesn't need to. It may not need tuition nearly as much as many universities do. So it might be destructive to the university system to see widespread offering of free of free content. I have a question in maybe a different area. And again, I'm sorry to keep looking at this discussion through the lens of art. I'm not trying to bring it back to art all the time. But in art and design, everyone's running around crazy because of the budget getting lower and lower. And, of course, there's this question of can we privatize some of these things? Can we get corporate funding? And that's one solution to it. But is that there's some accountability and transparency all of a sudden that there wasn't before. Because we, for years, had money funneling into corners of the school where people were doing research, doing work, doing teaching that had no, I don't want to use the word oversight, but that nobody knew what they were doing, and they were getting increasingly kind of autonomous and irresponsible, I think, in my estimation of what I've seen going on. Yeah, we just kept funneling money to it. And now we have to all show each other what we're doing, and that's, to me, getting towards a more responsible academic community, is that we're open about what we're teaching and how we're evaluating work and how we decide what gets taught and what doesn't. And I wonder if there's any parallel to that in the sciences, or if you guys are just more responsible to start with and haven't had to deal with that.
Yeah. I actually think from my perspective, I think there's actually less sharing than there was in the past in the sciences. Not that I'm not a scientist, but I work in the building with a lot of them. And I think because of this constant rush for federal funding or external funding of whatever sort, whether it's corporate or it's federal government or state government, whatever, it's kind of like this little lockbox of, you know, we're doing this job, we're working on that grant, we're working on that grant, and it's not necessarily a big collective organization anymore as far as let's get together and talk about what we're doing, because it is competition. And I think the environment of, you know, not providing the funds for kind of general research or exploratory research and ideas that maybe can't get a grant yet, produces this environment of, I better kind of hold things to myself, or I might not be the one who gets the next grant for this, because only a certain number of people are going to get the grant.
Because it's so niche, the way the...
Yeah, it is. You know, and this goes back to how NSF is funded. Of course, NSF's funding has, I don't know if it's actually gone down, but certainly its percentage of the GDP or whatever, I'm sure it's gone way down. And, you know, the director of the educational directorate of NSF gave a talk here, 6 months ago, Judith Romali, and she talked about how NSF has to entirely change the way it does its job, because the public is not going to support NSF anymore without seeing these kinds of success stories, you know, without seeing the direct benefit to the public. And I think that is probably their reaction to having their funding cut over time. And I think as everybody's funding gets cut from public funding sources, everybody ends up kind of trying to hold on to what they have and not lose it and that kind of a thing. So, I don't know.
And they define that public benefit, just a quick comment, as often as meaning economic output rather than meaning some type of overall social benefit. So, you know, saying that there's this trickle-down idea, you know, if the economy increases, then therefore taxes increase, more people are employed.
It's quantifiable. Public benefits are quantifiable in a way that makes them seem not debatable. Like, who's to define the public good?
I don't hear many quality of life indices talked about. You know, why aren't there more quality of life indices? They could be made. Certainly, they can be reduced to numbers, etc. So we talked about
it. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's something that's absent from the public dialogue, is the benefit of basic research. And scientists owe it to the public to explain to justify why we need the level of funding that we need, because there are many other uses for that money, many social ills that could be cured with that money. I think that the utility of basic research was something that was a lot more in the forefront during the Cold War, when it was clear that we were in competition with the Soviet Union and that basic research was what was going to decide who came out ahead in that. And since the United States has established itself as the only superpower, there's the question of what use basic research is to the public good hasn't come up in conversation.
I think you're exactly right. I think it's funny because I think the competition that surrounded the Cold War and the idea that basic research had a social good was really also heavily supported by the fact that the competition was mainly a military competition, and the funding was primarily federal funding and military funding for things that would be of use to the Department of Defense for nuclear technology and those kinds of things. And now that we don't have that same rush towards war, which actually seems kind of funny because we do have that same rush towards war, so it seems funny to say it, but I think you're right. I don't know why. I think you're right. People need to better explain why basic research is useful. But I think the government didn't necessarily ever really think basic research was that useful. They just thought it would be useful to them at the time for what they needed.
And I think that raises some questions that Rosemary emailed earlier, which has to do with jobs and funding priorities. And I think it also touches on Kevin's question about whether we can come up with a more nuanced way of looking at this than saying publicly funded research good, privately funded research bad, past good, present bad, which is that back in the Cold War, when my dad went to, I feel like I'm talking about him a lot, when my dad went to graduate school in 1964, he was able to support his wife and a child on his NSF fellowship for the 4 years he was in school. And he was studying social psychology. It wasn't directly applicable whatsoever to, they had a house on the beach. and with the change of the funding structures also meant very real changes in the working conditions on campus. And I know Rosemary did a lot of thinking about this, so I'm going to turn the mic over to her.
There are a lot of ways to go with this, so I'm not sure which way to pick first. Yes, as a grad student who is about to finish, one of the things that is of great concern to me and of great concern to my peers is our job prospects when we finish. In terms of finding an academic position, we're looking at about 25% of grads are going to have an academic position when they, a tenure track academic position when they finish. So most of us will end up in non-tenure track positions, which aren't as common in the sciences as they are in the humanities, or in industry. But with industry funding more and more science within the university, they're able to do a lot of outsourcing. And it's much cheaper to get a grad student to do your research than to hire a graduated grad student. And we're talking about a factor of four difference in cost, at least.
Background benefit of the university being there to support the person in that whole environment and everything that happens when they're in that environment, the people they can interact with, and the resources at their disposal is immense.
Right. And that means that when I graduate, chances are there aren't going to be as many industry jobs for me because industry is using my fellow grad students instead. There are other, there's so many impacts that that I think that corporate funding has had, but I'll just leave it with that and it will go around and come back, I'm sure. So.
Yeah, but 25% tenure track.
Oh, no way.
Just shocks you.
No. I'm sure it's for MFAs. It's got to be lower than that.
I mean, I wonder. I just curious if you do. If it's like 1%.
I mean, I'm sure that people like the College Art Association have done those stats. Yeah. And every time I see anything like those, they're really awful. Yeah. But yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have something to say?
No, I was just trying to pass the mic.
To go back, it seems that a lot of the, it's been mentioned a few times, but it seems to me that one of the biggest issues that comes up in this is the intellectual property rights and patents. And again, where I'm coming from the music business, it's a big debate that's going on right now. And I think that in the long term, solution or improvement, I guess, that I can see coming that would potentially improve some of the issues that are being discussed here is reworking that whole system and coming up with a better way to go about it. Again, in the music business, they're starting to look at, because they've been forced to, if the idea of owning a song and controlling it in every one of its nuances and every little way that it's displayed is the right business model that makes it make sense even in a commercial setting, let alone its kind of public benefit. My personal belief is that's in coming from the point of view of music. I think that music started as being kind of a communal expression that was given to everybody, and the fact that people could make money off of it as a performer, I think, is fine. But the idea of trying to only allow your work to be distributed if it's sold so that you make a profit isn't the best model for for the music business.
Distributors of, you know, once you've digitized music and you've aggregated these things, and then you're selling them, whether it's online or in CDs, the work on that side of the distribution has exponentially, I'd say, decreased, because not so much the work has decreased, but the work that's necessary in order to distribute is exponentially decreased, because at this point, any artist can publish directly to the web, for instance. And in the publishing, in scientific publishing, I think there's a similar thing happening, where you have these scientific journals which can cost thousands of dollars per year, and the people who submit articles don't end up getting that benefit. Sometimes the reviewers get paid well, but often reviewers are doing it on a voluntary basis as well, and it's part of their, you know, they have a gig as a professor at a university or researcher, and and that's not their primary source of income. So publishing, even though it's being increasingly privatized and there's kind of an accumulation happening into a few companies like Elsevier that are controlling these resources and jacking the prices up, they're on the in terms of the implementation side, this is, you know, there's no reason the reviewers could be voluntary. The publishing is you know, trivial to implement on the web, and then the people who write the articles, that's, you know, part of their kind of career stepping, and it's not so they don't make their funding from writing the articles. So the publishing industry isn't even necessary in the case of in the case of scientific publishing. It's like, and I think they understand that, and that's why they are working so hard to kind of retain their rights and protect their rights.
Well, they've been property. I mean, they've been extracting huge profits. The music industry, for example, has been extracting huge profits that go well beyond their costs, it seems like, for a very long time. And I think, in some sense, this whole, you know, the web being available and allowing individual artists to bypass the entire music industry has made them have to, you know, turn and go, okay, well, we've been ripping everybody off for so long, we may be better fucked. They're not going to take it anymore because they don't have to.
Go ahead.
In some sense, I think that scientific publishing differs a bit from the case of music or art, where your art does not need to be peer-reviewed to be accepted by the community at large, whereas my science needs to go through this peer-review process, or nobody, absolutely nobody, is going to look at it. They're not going to care if I put it on a web page or not. And I think that differs a bit from the case of music. So I'm not sure that's quite as easy to sidestep.
Maybe a little bit, but at the same time, as you know, if I write a song and put it on my webpage, nobody's going to look at it either. You need the backing of the industry, the acceptance of the industry, to be a vehicle to get your music out there. You know,
the last
certain about music to percolate up or something.
Okay. Well, there's, I think there's also a little bit more multiplicity in terms of the art worlds and the music worlds. There's that they're plural worlds. They're institutional, market, and popular, concert hall, a symphony, coffee shop circuit, and all of those things sort of have different standards as well, which I think are valuable to maintain that diversity. I wonder if there could be any analog in science as well.
Thinking about publication, a few years ago the Yale librarian came here and spoke about prospects for, you know, negotiating with the publishers for reasonable rates and reasonable reuse conditions and so forth. And I asked her whether she thought the publishers were going to realize the prospects for dramatically cutting costs, you know, given the new distribution technologies. And she said no, that it wasn't going to happen with them. It would have to happen by reinventing, you know, there'll have to be new publishers, as I guess the public library science is an instance of that happening. Yes. So a bunch of editors of various journals have just given up on trying to get their publishers to work under reasonable terms, and they have, a number of them have just resigned from the journals that they were editing and formed, there's a family of new journals. You may know more about this than I do, because I think a bunch of them are biology and chemistry journal. No? Okay. BLOS would be the thing to look for. But it is happening, but it's happening by excluding the old.
That are non-profit, and the reviewers are voluntary, and so it's but of course it still, I think, remains the case, in order to validate yourself in the echelons of academia, you have to kind of publish in these certain areas that are certain journals that are sort of set of journals, yeah, that are respected, and I don't know yet that the respect has transferred or propagated to these open journals.
In some cases, it has. The PLOS journals have carried the prestige of their editors, which is what they needed. But it's a struggle, and also it's a struggle for the libraries, who have to, at least in the interim, you know, maybe eventually the old publishers will give up and go out of business, or the old journals will become irrelevant. But in the meantime, there are old expensive journals, and there are new, much less expensive journals, which still cost something.
Okay, just one more comment. I'm really intrigued by the history we started off with of in science, intellectual property's movement from material to, I think, what you just described as a commerce of ideas. And since we've been comparing art and science industry, I'm thinking about how that applies to the arts. And I think in the arts that I run in, the more an artwork becomes about the idea and not about a material specificity, the less, the more difficult it is to hold up intellectual property and ownership to it, and yet the less stakes there are, so it doesn't really matter. There's not many artworks that are idea-based as opposed to sort of material object-based, for which people are scrambling to give money, so it doesn't really matter.
Or to own.
Yeah. So, like, there was a really encouraging case, a legal case in Rhode Island a couple of years ago when I was living there, where Providence, Rhode Island has stumbled across a real moneymaker, and that they commissioned a public artwork called Water Fire. And it's basically these floating braziers down the river that runs through the city. And a few times in a summer, they build these big bonfires on these things, and everybody comes out, like the whole state of Rhode Island's down there walking up and down the river, looking at the fires on the river, and there's music playing, and it's all kind of getting in touch with your primal spirit and stuff. Well, as is the case in Rhode Island, there's so many, like, really, what's that? It hasn't reached that state. That's left for the art students to try. But anyway, there's a lot of great sort of local entrepreneurship in Rhode Island, and a couple of the smaller communities that had like an old mill pond or two decided that this would be good for their business. So they started building these little floating fires and having their own. And the artist of Waterfire, Barnaby Evans, got really upset and took them to court. Said, you know, this is my project. You can't take this. And the judge actually decided, you can't put a patent on fire and water because it's too abstract. Nobody can own it. It's just too simple. So it's like,
original technology.
Yeah.
Which is where I was leading is I don't know much about who oversees the patents and stuff like that and where it's going, but Clear Channel was just recently granted a patent on the idea, the business method of recording live music and selling it at the venue, which there are a number of artists who are out there doing it, but they were granted a patent on the business method of doing it. So basically nobody can record their own music and sell it at their shows something I was unaware of. Did you know that somebody owns the patent for transferring media files over a network, which basically includes any kind of downloading. It's music downloading, and a lot of the major downloading companies have paid millions of dollars to license this right, and nobody stood up and challenged it, but they own the right. It's for music, for movies, for any media files that are transferred over a network. Somebody owns the patent of that business model, that idea, and it's just getting ridiculous. It's like, basically, to me, the Clear Channel thing was like somebody could have patented making hamburgers and selling them out of a business, and nobody could ever open up a restaurant again, you know, or making food on the roof.
It seems that there's a general agreement that that science should be funded to create benefits for society. The disagreement often comes in terms of what kind of institutional structures or lack thereof create that benefit for society. The whole area that we haven't talked about, that we won't have time to talk about really, is what kinds of research does and doesn't happen because of the kinds of funding opportunities that there are, you know, in terms of research into weapons or even, you know, the whole Moore's Law epidemic, where we have computers become faster and faster and faster, and yet they also require more and more power and use even though they're becoming much faster, they require more materials, and there's kind of all environmental effects to all of this. And so there's a whole side to this where, you know, I've talked with engineers that say that you could reduce the power consumption of computers fourfold without even getting into any kind of serious research, just with some kind of basic changes. So I think where science holds a lot of potential will be with, you know, if it could be organized for the purpose, would be to reorganize the production of technology to be environmentally, ecologically sound.
I think following up on that, some questions need to be asked, whether the state funding, which is usually what we mean when we say public funding, is we sort of think of the state and the public as interchangeable, when there's a debate to be had there, would necessarily guarantee something for the public good. So I'm thinking about right now pharmaceutical research. There's almost no research being done in terms of new ways of fighting malaria, even though, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die every year from malaria. Whereas, what? Bill Gates is funding it?
I mean, I think Bill Gates' model is almost right. You know, look at the need, look at the cost effectiveness of how to donate money, and then go for it.
Well,
he's gained some respect.
He also put, you know, he's the largest philanthropic donation in history, like $17 billion he's donated to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the majority of that money goes to buy computer infrastructure for schools and software. So, I mean, there's definitely, I don't want to negate, like, kind of that the
you know, the generosity of that, but we don't want to kind of forget that there's also a positioning not only of selling his products to the schools, but also positioning the students to be primarily, you know, educated with the Microsoft operating system and what's their preference going to be when they grow up, you know.
Well, and also, you know, do we really want to go to a patronage model? Because regardless of how rich individuals get, societies are still going to be that much richer. And I don't want to rely upon a benevolent dictator for what is happening in my culture. So, you know, the malaria, getting back to the malaria, you know, question, you know, if our government was going to be funding basic research for pharmaceuticals, they're not going to be funding malaria either, because, you know, white people in this country don't get it. And that need isn't going to be filled through either model. And so some sort of other sort of more internationalist, non-statist, non-corporate way has to be developed for that those kinds of things to ever be addressed.
There's a self-regulation of industries that happens that is problematic in the sense in terms of, for instance, the biotech industry, you know, is self-regulated. They're only regulated to this in the sense that they have to fund research to investigate their products to make sure they're safe, but they get to determine the terms on which that happens, and they do rig it up. There's a researcher at the U of I who was looking into the BT corn, and he discovered something that was potentially problematic, and because of the kind of weird constraints that Monsanto was funding him set up in terms of what the constraints are and how the research has to develop in order for to be able to publish the results of that research, they were able to kind of corner him with loopholes and prevent him from publishing research that would potentially be damaging to Monsanto. So by putting the regulation in the hands of the companies that who are being regulated, the conflict of interest creates a situation where the science won't really do its most efficient job of finding the problems. So I guess that does get, we are getting into the what kind of research does and doesn't happen.
I guess I just wanted to make a comment on bias coming from the corporations that fund the research and the public perception of that bias. I think that even if you have a situation where the researcher himself or herself is not being biased by the source of their funding and is allowed to publish either sort of result, the fact that the public will worry about whether or not that bias exists calls into question the legitimacy of the scientific results as far as the public is concerned, and I think that is very damaging to a democratic society.
Who they will provide their funding for. I mean, they you know, you put your grant proposal into Monsanto. Monsanto gets to decide who award the grant to. There's no independent vetting mechanism for any of this, and this is the entire pharmaceutical industry, the agriculture industry. The things that have the most relevance to public health. So.
All right. On that note, I think we need to stop. Thanks, everyone.